up is down, left is right, and a perfectly made, clean bed is, well, it's not a sign of warm hospitality.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, it's actually a terrifying, spine-chilling omen.
Right.
And, you know, if you're the kind of person who loves a good aha moment, and as someone who prefers to skip the, like, the information overload, you probably know that the best way to understand human psychology is sometimes to look at completely alien cultures.
Definitely.
So that is our mission today on this custom-tailored deep dive. We are stepping into a world where your fundamental baseline for reality gets entirely flipped on its head.
Yeah, and we have an incredibly rich set of sources to explore with you today. We're actually analyzing a massive stack of detailed logs from, it's a 2008 collaborative fantasy role-playing campaign.
Which is just so cool.
It really is. The setting is this fictional world called Mirari. And the text itself, I mean, it provides an absolute masterclass in world building, investigative storytelling, and just character dynamics.
Yeah, so our focus rests on three main characters navigating this completely bizarre landscape. There's Tristan, who is an honorable fae knight, meaning his combat skills are deeply intertwined with, like, ancient nature magic.
Right, very classic fantasy archetype.
Exactly. Then we have Hannah, a highly capable, slightly cynical explorer who has just seen way too much of the world.
She's very grounded.
Very. And rounding out the trio is Sam, who's this witty, older minstrel with a really sharp eye for a bargain.
A very useful skill, as we'll see.
Oh, absolutely. So they have been hired to solve a royal kidnapping. But before they can even, you know, look for clues, they have to survive a culture that views mundane beauty as a literal physical threat.
Yeah, the authors of this campaign plunge us straight into the architecture of culture clash. It's a brilliant inversion of those classic fantasy tropes.
How so?
Well, usually heroes arrive in a quaint village, or maybe a majestic citadel. Here they arrive in the goblin town of Greedle, and the environment is just immediately hostile to their senses.
Hostile feels like a massive understatement.
It really does.
I mean, their local guide is this toadie for hire named Skunky Merc.
Great name.
Right. And he immediately marches them to the local money changer because standard gold coins hold zero value in Greedle.
Not at all.
Yeah, you have to trade your gold for a currency called geese balls or possibly grease balls. The spelling varies.
Yeah.
But the logs note that the sheer texture and odor of these things are vile. Yeah. Like, the bag provided to carry them is so offensive it defies polite description.
And that detail is so important because it establishes the foundational economic philosophy of this entire goblin society.
Right.
Their entire commerce is built on the grotesque. Wealth isn't measured in shiny, refined metals, you know?
No.
It is measured in accumulated grime and foulness.
Which is wild, and the aesthetic shock hits our heroes even harder when it comes to their mounts.
Oh, the horses.
Yes. Tristan and Hannah ride into town on these magnificent, highly intelligent night steeds named Suhat and Princess Peach Blossom.
Beautiful app.
Exactly. In any normal fantasy setting, a crowd would part in awe. But Skunky Merc takes one look at these majestic animals, scoffs, and calls them dumb mules.
He's actually insulted by them.
He is. He actually tells the heroes the horses are far too pretty to be allowed near the palace. He suggests they breed them with local, brain-dead pack animals just to improve their bloodline.
I love that so much. The narrative is aggressively stripping away the character's presumed status.
Yeah.
A majestic steed suddenly transforms into a social liability. And the world building goes a step further by showing how goblins weaponize beauty.
Oh, the flowers. Skunky Merc walks through the crowded streets waving these fragrant corpse flowers in front of his face.
Right.
He uses a beautiful, sweet-smelling flower the way, like, riot police might use tear gas. He's clearing a path because no respectable goblin can tolerate a pleasant aroma.
It's so funny.
It is. My brain immediately tries to compare this to modern high fashion, you know, where sometimes a destroyed, paint-splattered pair of sneakers costs 10 times more than a pristine pair.
That is a really good analogy.
It's like an entire economy built on reverse psychology. Rolling in the muck is high society, and taking a shower is an act of violent rebellion.
Yeah, that captures the social dynamic perfectly. In Mirari, making the mundane repulsive forces the characters and you, the listener, to constantly reevaluate your surroundings.
Right. You can't trust your instincts.
Exactly. A compliment could be a deadly insult. A pile of garbage might be the equivalent of a royal vault.
Wow.
And this complete subversion of expectations forms the core conflict surrounding our missing royal, Prince Feasel.
Yeah, let's talk about the prince.
Yeah.
because the heroes finally reach the palace, and it stands out like a sore thumb in this town.
Completely out of place.
It features running fountains, skylights, towering, elegant marble pillars that reflect the high elven, Mirari-esque architecture of the wider world.
Which the goblins hate.
Oh, they despise it. Skunky Merc bitterly explains that Prince Feasel designed the place himself. The prince had studied the outside world and returned with this grand vision to bring, quote-unquote, culture to his people.
And we can clearly see the sociological friction here. By attempting to introduce indoor plumbing and regular bathing, Prince Feasel was attacking the bedrock of goblin identity.
Yeah, Skunky Merc grumbles about the bathing mandate like it was a war crime.
Right.
The disgust was universal across the town.
And that widespread cultural disgust provides our motive.
I see.
Prince Feasel was trying to force a society to change against its fundamental nature. He disrupted the status quo, making him a prime target for enemies both foreign and domestic.
So everyone had a reason to want him gone.
Exactly. And that resentment sets the perfect stage for the mystery of his disappearance.
So the trio enters the beautiful, despised palace to meet Princess Greedle, who is the missing prince's fiancée.
Right.
She is a massive goblin wearing a blonde wig. And she is entirely inconsolable.
Just weeping.
Yes. And when we first meet her, the logs describe her sitting on a throne. But the throne itself is completely invisible because it's hidden entirely by her own formidable girth.
It's such a vivid image. And she informs the investigators that the prince vanished the night before their wedding.
And the detail that horrifies the princess the most is just incredible.
That's my favorite part.
She wails about the guards checking his room and finding him gone. But the true tragedy, the thing that has her squealing in absolute terror, is that his bed was made.
Right, because to a goblin mind, a tightly tucked sheet or a smooth blanket obviously conceals tripwires or poison or hidden daggers.
A clean bed is a death trap.
Exactly, but her phobia inadvertently preserves the evidence.
Oh, because they wouldn't go in.
Right. Because the room was terrifyingly tidy, not a single goblin guard dared to cross the threshold.
That is so smart.
It really is. Our heroes are handed a pristine, undisturbed crime scene.
So Hannah, Tristan, and Sam comb through this spotless room. Hannah inspects the architecture and finds a deep, violent gouge on the underside of the windowsill.
Which proves someone or something forced its way inside.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Tristan finds scattered parchment on a desk. But the notes written by the prince are completely illegible, just a chaotic jumble of letters.
And he only cracks the code when he holds the parchment up to the light.
Right.
He realizes the prince wrote the entire message backward.
Which is very clever.
Yeah.
And the decoded message mentions a mysterious locket the prince obsessed over.
Right.
And it specifically points to page 153 of a tome called The Great History of the Wilds.
So they head to the library.
They rush to the royal library. Which is hilarious, by the way, because the library consists of a single occupied shelf and features a massive warning sign reading, "Do not eat the books, please."
Yeah, a phenomenal touch of environmental storytelling.
It's brilliant. So they promise not to eat the inventory, they find the book, and turn to page 153. Staring back at them is a full-color portrait of Elisa, the great bandit queen.
Which reveals a deep lore connection for the party.
Yeah. Elisa is an old foe of Hannah's from a previous adventure who supposedly found redemption. Mm. And tucked inside the book's binding, they also find a small tuft of white fur.
So if we pause and analyze the narrative structure here, the authors have masterfully adapted a classic locked room mystery into a fantasy rule set.
Okay, wait, let me push back on that logic for a second.
Sure.
Because my brain is snagging on how these disparate items form a cohesive map. We have a gouge on a window, backward handwriting, a picture of a supposedly reformed bandit queen, and some animal hair.
Right.
How do those items translate into a specific travel destination? It feels like a leap.
Well, it seems disconnected until you categorize the clues by their investigative function. Think of it as method, origin, and destination.
Okay.
The gouge on the window establishes the method. It indicates a physical struggle and a breach originating from outside the palace walls, which rules out an inside job by resentful goblin servants.
That makes sense.
Then the white fur provides the origin of the attacker. White fur dictates a creature native to a frigid, snow-covered climate, meaning the threat came from far beyond Greedle's borders.
I see. And then the decoded notes pointing to the bandit queen provide the destination.
Exactly the synthesis required. The prince's obsession with Elisa combined with an attack by a cold weather beast, tells the heroes they are not dealing with local political rivals.
Right.
The prince was dragged out the window and taken toward the frozen, uncharted territory associated with the Bandit Queen.
The Wild Lands.
Hmm.
Entering that kind of hostile environment with nothing but goblin geese balls in their pockets is a guaranteed death sentence.
And that realization shifts the narrative from investigation to logistical survival. Knowing the destination is useless without the highly specialized preparation required to survive the journey.
And this preparation phase provides my absolute favorite sequence in these logs. It explores the visceral mechanics of magic in this world.
Oh, so good.
Princess Greedle directs them to the town shaman to get outfitted. His name is Clug.
And Clug utterly dismantles the archetype of the solemn, wise old mystic.
Completely. They knock on his door, and he answers wearing a pointy hat and absolutely nothing else.
Nope.
When they ask if he is the mighty shaman, he rolls his eyes, sighs heavily, and introduces himself as Petunia, the exotic dancer.
It's hilarious. But beyond the comedic introduction, Clug utilizes a magic system grounded in tangible, often brutal realism.
Yeah, it's not just waving a wand.
No. He takes that crucial tuft of white fur found in the prince's room and drops it into a stone mortar. He then tosses in two glowing blue fireballs and grinds the mixture together.
And then thick smoke billows out of the bowl and coalesces into a living, shifting face of a feline snow demon.
Right. Clug identifies the beast as an ice cat.
The smoke face actually snarls and snaps its jaws at Hannah before dissipating into the air.
Yeah.
So facing invisible, shape-shifting snow demons means our heroes desperately need gear that can pierce magical illusions, commonly called glamours.
And Clug agrees to craft glamour-breaking monocles, but this requires an examination of the philosophical costs of magic in Mirari.
It's a high cost.
It is. The authors do not allow players to simply wave a wand or spend abstract mana points. To reveal the truth, Clug requires a physical sacrifice. Right. He pulls a jagged blade and drags it across Tristan's forearm, collecting a quarter cup of the knight's blood. He explains that only the blood of someone who wields magic can forge a lens capable of cutting through magical deception.
It makes truth something you literally have to bleed for. It grounds the high fantasy in a very grim reality.
It really does.
And the grimness continues with their weapon purchases. Clug offers them gooey black spheres with fuses, basically sticky bombs and bizarre flamethrowers constructed from leather bags that look like deranged bagpipes.
But he refuses geese balls as payment.
Of course he does. For weapons of this caliber, Clug demands bee's knees.
Literal bee's knees, which highlights the absurd, extreme preparedness an adventurer must maintain in this setting.
Because, like, who casually carries around a velvet pouch full of microscopic insect joints?
But Tristan does.
Tristan does. The noble Fey Knight barely blinks. He simply reaches into his satchel, pulls out a handful of tiny black specks, and counts them to the naked goblin's hand.
I love that. You never know when a random microscopic body part will be the exact currency keeping you from freezing to death in the wilderness.
Exactly. So armed with explosives and bloody eyewear, they still need a guide and thermal clothing. This introduces us to Rosie Nose.
Rosie Nose is a fantastic character.
She is a tomgoblin, described in the text as a goblin possessing the facial features and frantic energy of a terrier dog.
Very high energy.
She drops out of a tree, yaps excitedly, and greets Tristan by enthusiastically sniffing his crotch.
As dogs do.
Right. Tristan endures the greeting with extreme, uncomfortable politeness. And Rosie secures heavy winter coats stitched together from patchwork rat skins.
Nice and warm.
Right. Provided by a merchant named Ferdinand the Furrier. She specifically warns the party never to mention pickled eyeballs in front of Ferdinand, as he's incredibly touchy about the subject.
So many great little details. But underneath her comedic, dog-like mannerisms, Rosie Nose actually offers a profound masterclass in moral pragmatism.
How so?
Well, while casually chatting with the party, she mentioned she learned to read and write during her previous employment, serving Lord Eowyn.
Oh, right. And Tristan practically chokes at that.
Yeah.
Because Lord Eowyn is known throughout Mirari as the Destroyer. He's a massively evil, world-ending villain. Tristan demands to know how she could possibly serve a Dark Lord.
And her response forces the heroes to confront ground-level survival. She just wags her tail and explains she was his favorite rat catcher.
Wow.
He let her sleep near the fire, fed her scraps from his own table, and petted her. She tells Tristan, sometimes you gotta break a few eggs to save the world or something. I don't think too hard about it. I miss the big bed in the fireplace, though.
Wow, it really makes you think about our own compromises in the real world.
Right.
How often do people overlook a company's toxic practices or a leader's massive character flaws simply because the paycheck or the metaphorical spot by the fire is warm?
That's exactly the parallel.
She does not view him through a lens of cosmic good and evil.
No.
She views him as an employer who provided an excellent benefits package.
Because in a harsh, unforgiving world, strict morality is often a luxury only the wealthy or protected can afford.
That's so true.
Rosie is an animalistic survivor. Her pragmatism creates a fascinating friction with Tristan and Hannah, who operate on these high ideals of chivalry and justice.
So it leaves the heroes with a really sobering perspective as they finally leave the pungent reverse psychology stench of Greedle behind.
They're finally on their way.
Led by their pragmatic terrier goblin, wrapped in rat skins and carrying bagpipe flamethrowers, they march toward the treacherous mountain passes.
And the logs handle the environmental transition into the wildlands beautifully. The oppressive atmosphere just lifts.
Right.
The air turns crisp, the landscape bursts with vibrant greenery, and birds sing in the canopy.
But the beauty is entirely deceptive.
Oh, completely.
Rosie Nose points out the rich soil is essentially a massive continent-spanning graveyard. The forest is only so lush because it feeds on the thousands of corpses left behind by the Bandit Queen's ancient slaughters.
So the serenity of the woods is deeply rooted in historical horror.
Yeah. And understanding the inherent danger of their surroundings, the party smartly pauses to test their newly acquired blood-forged gear.
Which is a very good idea.
Very good. Hannah activates her magic to cast a glamour over her own body. She transforms her appearance into a terrifying wraith, complete with a flowing black cloak and glowing red eyes.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, and then she holds Klug's monocle to her eye and looks down at her own arm. Through the blood-stained glass, she sees her normal human arm, surrounded by merely a hazy, transparent outline of the monstrous illusion.
So the painful sacrifice paid off. The gear works flawlessly.
Yes, it does.
And that functionality proves vital almost immediately because the narrative reveals their past is already waiting for them in the shadows of the trees.
Oh, man, this part. Moving further up the trail, they stumble upon the carcass of a half-eaten deer. But the crucial clue is not the fresh kill.
No.
The vital detail is the fur stuck to the drying blood on the deer's ribs. It isn't the white fur of a snow demon.
It is pink fur.
Pink fur. Which completely shatters their working theory. The Ice Gats is white. Elisa, the Banded Queen, has ruddy hair.
Right.
Hannah stares at the pink strands, and the blood literally drains from her face as she realizes exactly what is hunting them.
It is an old nemesis, born from a seemingly harmless decision.
Yeah, let's give the backstory on this. In a campaign session long before this kidnapping, Hannah and her friends were battling a massive, deadly troll.
A huge fight.
Right. And instead of delivering a killing blow, they opted for a creative, supposedly merciful solution. They used a potent potion to permanently transform the towering troll into a tiny, fluffy pink bunny rabbit.
But that pink bunny retained the troll's intellect and rage.
Yes.
And it has been stalking them across the entire continent seeking vengeance.
It is simultaneously the funniest and most deeply unsettling concept imaginable.
Seriously.
This fluffy lapine previously attempted to assassinate the party by orchestrating a massive stampede of antelopes. And now it has tracked them into the desolate wildlands, and it just effortlessly ripped a full-grown deer to shreds.
From a storytelling perspective, this represents a brilliant narrative payoff.
Yeah.
The authors took what was almost certainly a throwaway comedic moment around the gaming table, turning a terrifying monster into a cute pet, and allowed that choice to incubate.
They let it grow.
Right. They transformed a joke into a source of severe, deadly consequences.
It is the terrifying consequence of their own mercy. So, knowing the beast is near, Rosie Nose volunteers to flush it out of the heavy brush.
Very brave.
The brave little Tom Goblin sneaks into the dense, quiet woods. Minutes tick by. The logs describe the environment going dead silent. The wind stops. The birds cease chirping.
The pacing here builds incredible, agonizing tension.
Suddenly, a guttural, blood-curdling shriek echoes through the trees, shattering the silence.
Oh, wow.
Flocks of birds scatter into the sky. Rosie Nose bursts out of the tree line at a dead panic sprint, her eyes wide with terror.
And the deep dive into this specific set of logs ends on a massive, pulse-pounding cliffhanger.
It does. heavy branches snap in half, and a furious ball of pink fluff explodes from the forest, hot on the goblin's heels. The face of the rabbit is contorted in pure rage and unadulterated bloodlust.
Leaving the audience on that image of a charging, murderous rabbit is just phenomenal pacing.
I am absolutely delighted by the sheer absurdity blending with genuine terror. I mean, a fey knight and a hardened explorer bracing for impact against a bloodthirsty pink lapine is the perfect encapsulation of this world.
It really is. Looking back over the journey we took alongside Tristan, Hannah, and Sam, we uncover layer upon layer of deliberate design.
So many layers.
We explored a world-building masterclass in Greedle, demonstrating how an economy of the grotesque and an architecture of reverse psychology can make a simple made bed feel like a death sentence.
Yeah, and we analyzed the mechanics of a meticulously plotted locked room mystery.
Right.
We saw how translating a gouged window, backward handwriting, and a tuft of fur into a clear map toward the frozen unknown really worked.
And we witnessed the visceral cost of magic, trading physical pain for the ability to see the truth, all while unpacking the grim pragmatism of a goblin who found safety in the shadow of a dark lord.
For you listening, diving into these complex, multi-layered narratives really sharpens your appreciation for the mechanics of great problem solving.
Absolutely.
It demonstrates how every tiny detail, from the insect joints used to buy a weapon, to a forgotten joke from a past adventure, weaves together to construct a living, breathing reality.
It highlights how actions ripple outward, reshaping the landscape of the story.
And that realization that a quick fix birthed a greater nightmare brings up a really fascinating psychological question I want to leave you with today.
Oh.
Think back to Hannah turning that deadly troll into a harmless pink bunny instead of finishing the fight. It seemed like a clean, elegant, merciful solution at the time.
It did.
But does altering a problem, rather than fully eliminating it, simply create a smarter, highly motivated enemy for your future self? Is the harmless bunny actually vastly more dangerous than the original troll? Because now it possesses a deep-seated vendetta and the element of surprise.
That's a great point.
Think about the implications of that the next time you decide to leave a difficult task only partially resolved. Until next time, keep exploring.